What about paganism? Disc 4, Common Misconceptions and Practical Application. As we come to the fourth and final CD of this teaching, I realize that we've covered quite a bit of information so far in this study. So let's take a few minutes and review what we've already learned. On the first disc, we examined paganism and idolatry from the viewpoint of the Tanakh. The religion of Israel was unique in the ancient world because it was both monotheistic and it did not use images or idols in its worship of God. We saw that the Torah's development of introducing the one true God and how it contains many regulations to keep Israel far away from idolatry and paganism. Hashem permitted neither worshiping pagan gods or idols, nor using idolatrous methods to worship Him. We also saw that throughout Israel's history, right up to the Babylonian captivity, the people struggled with temptations of idolatry. This was due in part to the influence of the nations surrounding Israel, and also in part to the role sexual immorality played in pagan worship practices. On Disc 2, we continued our study of idolatry from a biblical perspective by taking a look at paganism from the lens of the apostolic writings. We discovered that an important shift took place after Babylonian captivity in that Israel, for the most part, no longer struggled with the temptation to worship foreign gods. Instead, the thrust of the anti-idolatry passages in the epistles and the rest of the New Testament were directed at non-Jewish believers. Breaking with past practices of idolatry and avodah zarah proved to be quite difficult for these new converts to monotheism. The Gentile culture and way of life of the Roman world was so wrapped up in idolatry that it was near impossible at times to escape it. Therefore, the apostles and even the latter church fathers are not short on words exhorting believers to flee from any form of idolatry. While there is some spiritualization of idolatry in the apostolic writings, the majority of admonitions are directed at real, tangible idol worship. In Disc 3, we began to discuss practical application. In particular, we discussed the prohibitions of avodah zarah as they relate to certain non-biblical holidays, as well as some forms of exercise and sports. We learned that these can be murky waters, and not everything is as cut and dry as we would perhaps like. We saw that in Jewish law, two principles govern the permissibility of non-Torah customs. Does the custom or holiday still maintain its connection to avodah zarah? And can the custom be explained logically? But even within Judaism, there is disagreement on various holidays and practices. We also attempted to cut through and bring balance to the superstitious paganoia trend within some Hebrew roots circles through careful analysis of the origins of each holiday. In the end, we attempted to show that it is best to let everyone make decisions about participating in various holidays and customs themselves. These are difficult decisions that require much thought and prayer. The weighty matters of honoring relationships and family need to be weighed against the often inconsequential and obscure pagan origins. We need to allow people to come to different conclusions than us and not be judgmental, so long as everyone is seeking to honor both God and His commandments against avodah zarah. For this final lecture, we will continue on the theme of practical application by examining some common misconceptions out there in the Hebrew Roots movement, and sometimes even in Messianic Judaism, regarding paganism. Most of these rumors are started by what I affectionately refer to as the paganoia crowd. As a self-confessed former paganoia person myself, I can attest to the damage that this type of thinking can lead to. As we have been pointing out, sometimes it seems like people think that anything with any pagan association or any resemblance to anything that was once used in association with idolatry is by default evil and must be rejected. But if that were true, I'm sorry to say, we'd have to throw out the Bible. We touched on this a little bit in the beginning of the third lecture, but let me explain this a little further. Archaeologists in the 1930s uncovered a whole library of Canaanite literature from Ugarit Canaanite literature older than our own Bible. What scholars surmised was that the Hebrews adopted not only the Canaanite language, but also the Phoenician alphabet for writing it. The discovery of the Ugarit texts shows that the biblical Psalms, whatever their date, are indebted to a Phoenician hymnology that had a long tradition behind it. The Psalms borrow heavily from Canaanite poetry, word pairs, and even the style of parallelism. In other words, the repetitions that make Hebrew poetry. There are descriptions of Canaanite gods we find retrofitted to speak of the Lord in the Psalms. For example, in Canaanite Psalms, Baal is depicted as the one who rides on the clouds, strides over the mountains. The mountains quake before his voice. He throws lightning bolts like javelins, and numerous phrases from the Psalms appear almost verbatim in much of these older Canaanite hymns. What is more, the elder god of the Canaanite pantheon is called El, which is a name of God often used in the Hebrew Bible. So is the Bible pagan? There are many, many parallels between biblical texts and older pagan texts from the ancient Near East, not to mention all the parallels between sacrifice, temple, priesthood, laws of clean and unclean, and so forth. We need to be careful about how far we take labeling things pagan that have pagan associations. I have personally seen people take these things so far that they end up rejecting the entire Bible. The Paganoia movement is not actually limited to the Hebrew roots world, conspiracy theorists, or the modern internet age phenomenon. One of the earliest pioneers in researching out pagan origins of holidays and customs was the 19th century English minister Alexander Hyslop. Hyslop was a well-known critic of the Roman Catholic Church and wrote a pamphlet against Catholicism that eventually expanded into the well-known book entitled Two Babylons, or The Papal Worship Proved to Be the Worship of Nimrod and His Wife. He sought to show that the Catholic Church was basically a Babylonian mystery cult and that the Protestant churches were the true followers of the God of the Bible. He traces all of these pagan influences in Christianity back to Constantine. Unfortunately, despite the popularity of his book, a lot of his scholarship is sketchy, inaccurate, and often just completely wrong. Thus, while it can appear convincing and persuasive, in many of the pagan influences and roots it purports to be present in Christianity, it does not hold up under scholarly scrutiny. Many more books have been written on the coattails of Hyslop's work, and many of them have come out within the last 15 years or so. We will examine some of the theories in these books and try to show where they fall short. While we obviously will not have time to cover all the ideas presented in these books, it is my hope to at least lay some groundwork to show the fallacies in this type of thinking. Once again, it cannot be restated enough that these theories are not just unscholarly and wrong, but they are extremely divisive and dangerous as well.